Hello, returning happies and new listeners. This is Steve Bennett Martin.
And this is Stephen Martin Bennett. And welcome to A Lifetime of Happiness.
The podcast where we take you on our journey through some of the movies, television shows, and other bits of pop culture that are helping to keep us happy, while hopefully bring a smile to your face along the way.
And with today's episode, we'll be going under the sea. Under the sea.
What? But babe, we already did The Little Mermaid.
No, darling, it's Titanic, but the song applies because the boat sank and everyone died.
Well, that's a little dark, babe. But on a lighter note, let's welcome back special guest Ronnie Diamond. Welcome.
Hi, Ronnie.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for having me.
Welcome back. And before we get into some of the other things, tell us what's been going on with you since we last chatted.
Well, since we last chatted, I was finally able to get fully vaccinated, get a European health pass, or what they call the passe sanitaire, which is allowing me to go through Europe and whatnot, and then secure flights all the way from France back to my parents in Kentucky, which basically meant I flew from France to Spain, to England, to DC, to Charlotte, and from Charlotte to Huntington.
That's a lot of stops and a lot of layovers.
Fortunately, in first class, I was kept comfortable. But I did have such an ordeal, you'll never believe me. There was a short connection, really, between D.C. or from Charlotte to Huntington. Of course, you know, there are hardly any flights at all. You basically have to get in a hot air balloon to return here. And I got off the plane landing in Charlotte, and I saw an American Airlines worker. She looks fabulous with a scarf and her hair all up. And I said, excuse me, ma'am, would you mind pointing me in which direction to the correct gate E1 or whatever it was? And she's like, oh, I see you're going to West Virginia or someplace like that. I said, I see you know correctly. She said, I think I saw a movie about that once. I said, you did? And it was called Wrong Turn. I starred
in it. Oh, yeah.
That never gets old for me.
Never.
And now that you're back in the States, what's been making you happy?
Well, it's nice to be home with family again. You know, this is the longest time, really basically almost a year and a half that I hadn't seen family. And last Christmas was the first Christmas I had ever missed because there just really wasn't any way to return home with the pandemic.
And you're like me that we're extremely close with our family.
Of course. And to think that, I mean, it was really hard for my parents to, you know, my mom, it was really hard. But then, you know, my nephews who are now 4 and 5, that's a huge growing period.
Yeah. And you have another you have another niece or nephew on the way, don't you?
That's correct. I do, which is a nice surprise. And this little one will be due in December. So practically a Christmas baby or my birthday baby.
Oh, let's hope not.
Why not? I have a fantastic birthday.
Yeah,
it starts at the beginning of December, so usually I kick off the Christmas season.
Like you're willing to share with anyone, whether they're blood or not.
Sharing means caring, and I don't care.
Well, darling, what's been making you happy?
Well, work for once, but we are officially...
What's that?
Yes, bitch. But we opened up at work, and so we now have seniors living in our senior living community. I'm not just working for an empty building, selling a promise. People can move in now, and it feels fabulous.
And didn't you say that, like, they were already enjoying life, like, so much?
Oh, yeah, like, 24 to 48 hours in, they were all like, this is so worth the wait. And we're like, girl. But yes, we agree. It was almost worth the wait.
That's
well, may I move in too? Because, you know, I liked enjoying life.
And you look the age, so that would work.
Yeah, I was going to say, you have the emotional maturity of the seniors.
And the wrinkles to prove it. So, yeah, I think...
Now, you know that's a lie. Thanks to Cher's pioneering efforts, I too look the beautiful age of 17 pristine.
Been making you happy, my love?
Well, is not a shock to you or some of our listeners, I do enjoy a video game from time to time. Mm-hmm. And this week, the Legend of Zelda Skyward Sword HD came out for the Switch. And it's been making me very happy to, you know, relive the memories of Skyloft and just, you know, it's good to have indoor relaxing activities during the brutal heat of Florida summers.
Yes, and so would you recommend Skyward Sword as a binge or a purge?
It's absolutely a binge.
Similarly, I'm binging a video game as well. I'm binging Attila Ariza 2 Lost Legends and the Secret Fairy. What would you call it, babe?
Artillery.
Home video.
Artillery Big Old Fairy.
Yes, because it's part of the Attila series of games that are very niche JRPGs with a crafting system that's awesome. But Lommel has never been really good at getting the names, so he always makes fun of them.
Because he was playing one that was called, like, Artillery Moo Moo.
It was Artillery Maruru.
Artillery Moo Moo, like I said.
Yes.
And but darlings, I am sorry to interrupt, but I don't know what any of these words mean.
They're video games. Don't worry, we're going to bring it back to you in a moment, Ronnie.
So we also watched the Fear Street trilogy on Netflix. Ronnie, you read the Fear Street books growing up, didn't you?
I loved them. We had everyone. I was absolutely addicted. In fact, that's probably one of the first series that, you know, really where I think I truly became an avid reader at a younger age. And I couldn't put them down. I loved everyone. And I have to say, gone, because of the flights and stuff, and when it arrived in France, just I think it was last week or whatever, I was able to get through half of the first part.
Wait till you get to the end. It's so good.
I was going to say, we won't spoil
it's broken
it for
up in
you,
years.
It is.
It is. And it was just done really well. I mean, similar, like on a much smaller scale in the MCU, but the idea of having three movies that all have their own plots and own stories and everything, but finding a way to tie it all together, I think that they had a very tall task ahead of them, and they did it very well. The movies were well produced, the acting was good, the deaths were fun and shocking. And
for a Netflix movie, I was shocked at the gore.
Yeah, it was really good.
Yep.
So, no, that's true, yeah. And I mean, just from what I've seen.
Yeah, wait till you get further into it. But is there anything else that you've been watching or reading or listening to that you're really enjoying, Ronnie?
So I'll give a throwback. On the plane over, I watched two movies. The first one was I rewatched The Best Marigold Hotel, and I forgot how funny that was. So I think, and then every moment I was just laughing and laughing. But you also learn a little bit about India and that area, and I think it was really good. Plus, of course, the cast is fantastic. Anything with Maggie Smith is going to have me glued like hot oil. And
wait, glued like hot oil.
I don't understand like that.
What's that hair glue everyone uses in Florida or something? Anyway, or fix. Anyway. So it was fantastic to rewatch that again. You know, the movie's 10 years old now, so it's been
very
a while.
Good.
Right. So then, and I noticed this was available. It was Let Them Talk, and it starred Meryl Streep, and it's a recent movie. I don't remember seeing any publicity for it or any really marketing, and maybe it was because they filmed it during the pandemic, but it's new. It's very new. And she's an author, and she can't fly, and she takes some friends, and they go on basically the Queen Mary 2 to go to England for her to accept an award. And, of course, anything with Meryl Streep is going to be fantastic, in my opinion. I don't think there's anything she can't do, to probably include playing Batman if she so wanted.
I agree. I would watch Meryl Streep Batman.
Right. So, I mean, that's something that's out there. I had not heard anything about it. It was just an available movie for me on the screen, and I chose it. It was fantastic.
Well, and if you're interested in checking it out, a quick Google search shows that it was released on HBO Max in December of 2020, so it should still be there now.
Yeah, okay. I think people should watch it. It was good. And if you love Meryl Streep, of course, you'll love it.
Well, Ronnie, the big question for today is, why would we choose to cover Titanic?
So we can sing Celine's favorite song.
Now, why do you love Titanic?
So I love the story of Titanic, but I think, you know, the film that we're talking about today is mostly fictional. There are some real characters that are portrayed in that who existed in life 100 years ago. But I think overall it's for several reasons. And I think the top two reasons are that most of us can identify with or imagine putting all of our hopes and dreams for the future into something. And then what would happen if that something failed to unfurl or failed to materialize? And in the case for most of the steerage or the third class, that's really where we find ourselves. And then I also think for another reason, I think with the passing of the Titanic and the sinking of the Titanic, it's also really a bit of, well, I think there's some symbolism here, but it represents for me the sunset on the end of the Edwardian, the Gilded Age, the Wilhelminian Age, the Belle Epoque, because we're really only 2 years out from World War I, when everything in Europe will change, monarchies will fall, and we will see a brand new world emerge known as the 20s.
And less emphasis on the aristocracy.
Unfortunately.
I mean, they lost, you know, Guggenheim and J.J. Astor. So, like, titans of industry went down with the ship.
Yeah, they really did. They really did. And that's what I think. You know, it really, in a way, represents the sun setting on this period of time. And I think people can relate to that in the sense of, you know, a new, this decade ending, this decade beginning. And time seems to go a little bit faster now, but back then it didn't. But when we look back, we see that the sinking of the Titanic at this time in 1912, and then 2 years later, we're in World War I, and everything changed with World War I. So in that vein, it represents almost as if a saying goodbye or an adieu to a period of time.
Yes, and I didn't get any of that when I watched this movie because I was 11 years old the first time.
Yeah. Don't you win the Golden Star?
I do, yes. Well,
darling, why don't you
tell
us
I was only 8 when I watched it. So I
liar. Liar.
Liar. Oh, I still have some of my original bones over here. Let me pull this ear off. Oh, my ear. That's what I have to tell my That's what I have to tell my beautiful little nephews who are 4 and 5, Preston and Grayson. Don't grab Uncle Ronnie's new nose. Don't grab Uncle Ronnie's new nose.
I was going to say, that takes got your nose to a very dark corner. Yes, now this movie, if you're doing the math and know my age, it is a 1997 movie. It was written and directed by James Cameron, who you might also know from the movie Avatar, as well as Terminator 2 and Aliens.
Yeah, like, he's known for blockbuster movies that are still loved and respected to this day.
Yes, and it was released as a holiday movie. It was December 19th it came out and was released by Paramount Pictures with a $200 million budget, which sounds like a lot back then. How did it do?
Well, you know, a couple people went and saw it. You know, it only ended up making $2.195 billion.
Billion.
Yeah, with a B. That's like,
Steve, do I remember this correctly? I mean, I think we've had this conversation many moons ago in that didn't because we were both seniors in high school when
we were
I remember us, like, we got out of school that day, not legal, well, not, it wasn't really approved, but we all took like this unofficial senior skip day and went and saw it.
I know.
Oh, I may get in trouble. My mother doesn't know about that.
Well, it was like, I'm sure Steven never had a skip day.
Never. At all. And no, like, that was one of those things. It captured the country.
Oh yeah, it was the first movie I ever heard about of people like who were saying, like, I always saw it again and I saw it again, and I was like, why would you see a movie more than once? Which, I mean, I was 11 at the time, but I mean, you know, now people like do that all the time, but I think it's, you know, something that really captured the nation. Even my mom took us to see it and was like, we have to see it because everyone's seeing it.
Well,
my mom doesn't do movies.
Everybody, and so it was released near the end of the year, so it would qualify for the Oscars. And I remember the weekend it came out, we still had a couple more days of school before they let us out for Christmas break. And I had friends that saw it twice opening weekend, and I didn't see it till after Christmas during holiday break. But, like, even whenever we were gathered together for holiday as a family, like, with all the cousins and everything, even two of my cousins had already seen it twice. Mm-hmm. And that was, you know, in 6 days. So it was really something that people were going to see again and again and again.
Yeah, and it helps that it also not only was a great plot, but it had an all-star cast. It had Leonardo DiCaprio as Jack Dawson.
There was Kate Winslet as Rose DeWitt Decatur.
Yes, you have Billy Zane as evil douchebag Cal Hockley.
Kathy Bates as the unsinkable Molly Brown.
And there was support Perfect. From a whole bunch of faces you've probably seen before, like Victor Garber, Bill Paxton, and Francis Fisher.
Yep, and it ended up doing very well at the Oscars. It got 11 Oscars, and it had set, or it tied for a record of most nominations, I believe, at that point. It won Best Picture, Director, Song, and it also won Supporting Actress for The Old Lady.
Yes.
I do remember poor Kate Winslet, the cameras are on them when they're announcing the awards, and everyone had led her to believe that she was a shoo-in that year to win, and when they announced someone else's name besides hers, she did not howled or hide her emotions very well. I will always remember that moment of her look of shock and disgust when they said someone else's name.
I could imagine, and that's why I'll never be up for an award, because I would not be able to keep a poker face if I lost.
And that's exactly the same reason Joan Crawford rarely attended award shows.
Now, IMDb summarizes the movie as a 17-year-old aristocrat falls in love with a kind but poor artist aboard the luxurious, ill-fated RMS Titanic. Ronnie, would you say that that's what the movie's about, or how would you describe it to someone who's never seen
it before? I think you summed it up absolutely marvelously. I think he's lucky not to be playing the violin in Town Square. He's in abject poverty.
Yeah, I mean, he is a vagabond just traveling the world, making enough money to get by on as he experiences everything. And that would be Jack Dawson that we're talking about. He's the poor artist that on the Titanic, he's in over his head.
Yes, and he explains that he travels from place to place working, and that's how he lives day to day, never knowing what's going to happen when he wakes up in the morning. And that sounds fabulous to poor Rose.
Oh, the society girl.
But before we even get to her, as another sum up of our description of Jack Dawson, Leonardo DiCaprio, we cannot forget Francis Fisher's description, which was a dangerous insect that must be squashed quickly.
because Rose is the society girl being forced into a marriage, and Frances Fisher is playing Ruth, the mother that's trying to save their family through the marriage of their daughter, because Ruth's husband died and left them with debt and their good name.
Yes. And so Rose just feels so overwhelmed that she's ready to jump off the Titanic to her death when she meets Jack, who ultimately saves her. And it's kind of love at first sight. You can instantly feel that chemistry.
You can. But one of the things that I always... You know, the movie starts with that whole, like, present day searching for the diamond, and then old Rose comes to the ship and she begins telling her story. That's kind of like the forgotten part of the movie, except for the whole, it's been 84 years.
And it's been 84 years, and I can still smell the fresh paint. The china had never been used.
The sheets had never been slept in.
Titanic was called the Ship of Dreams, and it really was.
So, like, one of the things
I like the film, I have to say.
Really, I wouldn't have guessed.
I was going to say, I think you've seen this once or twice.
Never, moi.
Okay, so, like, when it first gets to back in 1912, and Rose steps out of the car with that lavender dress and the purple hat, I always picture you in my head because I think you'd look really good with that hat, Ronnie.
Well, I do, and that's the reason I had it designed. For me, in a special case, I need to wear something in crossing on the Queen Mary 2 in this upcoming year.
So, now, one of the other characters that comes on there is one of the most famous survivors.
Molly Brown.
Molly Brown, who becomes known as the unsinkable Molly Brown. And she is, as Ruth calls her, new money.
Yes, they definitely don't treat her the same way they do the other well-to-do ladies. She's a little more abrasive, which of course means that we love her.
Yes.
I don't find crude and lewd socially.
I was going to say, because crude and lewd, that would be you.
Thank you.
So, as we said, Rose is being married off to Cal, who is Billy Zane. He's an aristocrat, but he also feels very entitled to everything in life between feeling entitled to Rose yeah. and her attention and affections and just everything else. Do you, like, Ronnie, you know more about people from back then. Do you think his attitude is typical of men of those age, or do you think that other men in the aristocracy had more class and manners than Cal?
I would like to think that he represents a small portion of men at that time. Were there other men who were as boorish as he? Absolutely. Were there some who were more compassionate and more caring? Absolutely. So, I mean, we have to look at this, I think, with a very wide lens. The reality was, is that for the upper classes, marriage was not an event taken for love as a rule. These were binding events. These were acts of joining families together for preserving property, for ensuring continuity, and for ensuring, again, that families stay afloat. And we see this exactly with Rose and her mother, Ruth. Their money is gone. The father passed away and left them with debts. And in order to secure their status, which was the most important thing of all, they have to marry. Rose must marry well. And this is normal. This is really normal. It was happening all over Europe and the United States at that time. Again, in the reverse for Europe with titles. And the same was going on in Philadelphia society.
Well, and we also see this back whenever we were watching Downton Abbey, that Lord Grantham married Cora for her money. So it's slightly reverse, but exactly. their marriage was based on her fortune, because as it is for that family, the men in that family somehow find a way to lose the money.
Yeah, and you can tell that definitely was an upper class thing, because, I mean, Jack immediately asks Rose, like, do you love him? And she's just so caught off guard by the question. She's like, that's rude. You don't ask that. And I'm like, you know, for us poor people, like, that's just the first question you would ask if you were asking about a relationship. But the fact that for her, because it's so transactional, the idea of it being based off of love or does she love him just seems, you know, like a crazy question to ask and slightly personal.
Yeah.
Well, that's precisely correct, Steve. I mean, and we see this most of all. I think the best piece of evidence of this is when we look at, you know, homes from the Gilded Age or country estates or hunting lodges of the aristocracy, whether it be in the United States or in Europe, we will always see that for the married couple, they will have separate bedrooms. That's not, and separate beds and separate rooms for the ladies' maids and valets and all that. Well, those who sleep with the staff, but when traveling, that is. And so we don't see that usually with the bourgeoisie or the middle classes, and we certainly don't see it in the lower classes. They shared a bed. Families would sleep in one bed. That's all they may have had. But in the upper classes, they had separate bedrooms, and that's, I think, the best example, or at least it gives us some insight into understanding better how these social arrangements and contracts were made in order to preserve and to continue with status and tradition.
Well, speaking of status, the Titanic was not just for the wealthy. Like, the steerage was also able to board the ship and cross. Were the accommodations the same?
Well, that I think that's a fantastic question. The accommodations in steerage were considerably fantastic for the time. They had full meals. They had a place where they could dance. They had a place where they could gather and socialize. They also had their own decks. Interestingly enough, if you compare to Titanic to other ships for crossings at that time or other steam engines or whatnot, you'll see that the second class accommodations on Titanic are much like the first class accommodations on any of the other ships of that time. So, but for steerage, it was considered, I mean, we would have to just call it almost like a paradise in a sense. They were really traveling in style. Most of them had nothing. They had every belonging that they ever owned with them. So for them, it represented a nice piece of life for a little while.
Yeah, hardly any rats.
Hardly any rats. Now, darling, you've been on a cruise, and the room that you and your family shared, was it like Rose's suite? Or what would you compare it to?
Well, I went into...
Oh, I think, oh, you're talking to him. I thought you were talking to this darling again.
Yes, well, I remember having watched this movie at 11. I was just like, well, my parents, when we go on a cruise, it's definitely going to be like Rose's Cabin. And then it definitely was more like The Steerage, where it was the four bunk beds in a tiny little box that my parents and I and my brother got to share for a week.
Oh, my.
I know. I'm like, oh no, we're lower class.
Well, and but that is
I can I can shine a different shadow and a bit different bit of light on that experience.
Yeah, tell us about what first class is like on ships nowadays, Duchess.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest. Thank you. I think the biggest. I mean, honestly, if you're going to go on a cruise this day, the biggest thing you want is it just to make sure you get a balcony or a mini suite, something like that. It's going to give you a little bit more room, but the balcony. People say you're never in your room. You are. You're going to have breakfast out there. You're going to have coffee. You'll have tea. You'll have drinks. You'll do whatever. Have a balcony. As long as you have a balcony and you can get it moderately priced, you're good to go.
Good note.
Good. I mean, but as you see, the size of rooms this today, or okay, you've spent a lot of time in Europe, Ronnie. European hotel rooms, except for like the suites, are smaller than U.S. hotel rooms even.
Oh, definitely, definitely. And there's just not enough space. But I think something that we can see with something, and, you know, they've been building ships so large lately, Royal Caribbean, Carnival, they've been building these massive ships. They do have 2- and 3-story suites available, or what they often call now villas.
Wow.
And you'd have your own promenade. So, you know, in looking back at, you know, Titanic for just a second, you know, that we saw what Rose had and what Ruth had and what Hockley had as part of their, you know, their suites. But, you know, the second class, they had fabulous rooms as well. I mean, they were mostly made up of tourists, like clergy, academics, and the middle class from, you know, America, England and Scotland. Mm-hmm. But they had their own library, their own promenade. It was very luxurious for them as well.
It's so interesting with all of that. But as you like, Rose has all of these things, and a lot of people that are watching the movie would be like, wow, she has everything, until you look at her wants, needs, and emotions. And Rose is seeing her. Yeah, she sees a life of no choices in front of her, a life of obedience and no love. And she sees it as a life of nothing, not a life of privilege. And so she has a panic attack and a meltdown and runs across the ship with the intention of jumping off the end. Jack sees her running by, and he goes and he realizes what's happening, and he starts calling her out, kind of annoying her, you know, like calling out her privilege and things. But then he also says, you know, you've involved me now, you know, you jump, I jump, I have to get in and save you, and that water is going to be cold. And she's like, oh no, the fall will kill us. No, it'll hurt, but we'll live. But the water is going to be cold. And it just, that first interaction with them, even though that's not their first full-fledged interaction, because he had seen her up on the deck, and the first glance, he was just like,
it was smoldering.
Yeah, it was, wow. And at first, you would think that she wouldn't even acknowledge him, but she gave him multiple glances that first time.
Yes.
And now they're together, and he does convince her, don't jump. And as he's helping her get back on, she does slip, and he really does physically save her life.
Yes. And then, of course, when he gets her off of deck, though, all they heard was a woman screaming, and they run to see him on top of her, and so it looks very rapey. But she defends him when they're confronted, and his reward is being invited to dinner.
Yes. And, like, you see it even today with certain things of people that are a fish out of water with this. I do immediately like Molly Brown goes out of her way to help Jack. And, like, we've all seen Gilligan's Island, where Mr. and Mrs. Howell took all of their clothing with them on this 3-hour tour. And Molly Brown puts Jack in a tuxedo that belongs to her son. And you're like, he's not even on the ship. Why did you bring all of his clothing? And
I thought about that last night.
That's what I kept thinking of. And I was like, why do you have all the stuff? And I was like, well, I never really questioned why Ginger wore an evening gown on their 3-hour tour, or the Howls had like trunks of clothes for everyone to wear. So,
but yeah, you don't question why I haven't been wearing my own Rose DeWitt Bacator outfit while trying to board the Titanic.
Well, I like those were ferries that take you around, you know, the area.
Whenever there are questions in films, like, and I have to have an answer to it. So I'll make up my own little fantasy in my world, and I'll probably even make two or three up just to you know, soothe my nerves, as it were. And I often think, well, maybe she must have gone shopping for him, or perhaps they had already been traveling together, and then he departed before she, or something like that. So that's the answer.
I like that answer.
Yeah. Now, thank you. I also have one to help out with poor Ruth. And what happens to her afterward?
Oh, we will definitely get to that. So they're at this dinner, and most people at the dinner are following their good breeding and their good manners, and they are trying to make Jack feel welcome. Except for Ruth and Cal, who seem to be going out of their way to make sure everyone knows he doesn't belong.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and then, you know, through that, he encourages her to live.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, do... What was it written on the note?
Oh, now I can't remember what it said about... You know, it was kind of like, seize the moment, live every day.
I'm testing you guys, and you guys are failing. Ronnie, I thought you'd seen this movie once or twice.
Well, that's one of those pieces that I changed. I created a fantasy. And my note said, meet me around back.
Yes. And she ends up meeting him around back.
Yeah. And because as the gentlemen go off for cigars and brandy and conversation, and the women stay around for gossip, but Rose goes to meet Jack and for a real party, and they go down to the steerage where the bands are, like, the people that are traveling have just performed with the instruments they brought. There's alcohol for everyone. Jack's dancing with his best girl, Cora, this little girl that looks to be about 7 or 8, which, fun fact, originally at that time, the part was going to go to Lindsay Lohan, who was like 11 or 12 at the time, but they felt that it actually was slightly too old for the character to be as cute as they needed it to be, so they ended up going younger. But I thought that was funny that Lindsay Lohan was almost in Titanic.
Yes.
I think they made the right choice. although seeing her go down, that wouldn't be happening. Wait, no, I take that back. She's already gone down so many times.
I was going to say, she's gone down a lot.
I love Lindsay Lohan.
I know, and Steven just keeps hoping she gets back up.
Yeah, and it's one of the probably first times in Rose's life where she can just let go. And after a bit, she doesn't care what anybody's thinking, and she's just having fun.
Yeah.
Do you think, Ronnie, that that's typical for people that are in the aristocracy, that they never get to
have fun?
Have fun without thinking of what's someone going to say or think?
I think it's one of those situations where boys will be boys, as we used to say. I think for the girls, there aren't that many Roses or Lady Sibyls out there who really go and get to have any fun. Mm-hmm. But I think for the younger boys or the young gentlemen, I think it was, you know, it's a bit of hypocrisy, if you will. Sure, they certainly had outlets and avenues to them that young ladies did not. So for the girls, I do think it's very rare. For the boys, because it would lead to their ruin, right? Their reputations were worth so much more in the boys, and the boys would be patted on the back, or they would just be shucked off, or they're sowing their roots. And, you know, even young men at this time, it was always called, they do a big tour of Europe after they finish high school or university, something along through there, their private studies. And so it was always almost expected that they would, you know, go off and sow the wild oats, mm-hmm. or, you know, to say. What was not expected, that they came back tertiary syphilis, which they often did.
Well,
but what you're saying is the patriarchy's always been horrible.
Yeah, I mean, that's the one thing that we definitely know. I mean, with the changing of society, we're seeing, you know, women have more opportunities, more of a voice. And that's something that was, well, it's a shame it didn't happen thousands of years ago, but it's finally happening now. And I think that's good for everyone, both men and women. But there we don't get to see it as often. So, again, I think Rose is certainly a rarity, as was Lady Sybil in Downton.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I know that, I mean, for this amazing night, if we weren't sure if Cal was just a douchebag or a flat-out villain, it was very apparent the following morning when he threw his temper tantrum over the table.
Oh, and when he... And so that was a good character moment for all of them. Like, it shows Cal's anger that without hitting her, you know that it's in his character to hit her.
Oh, yeah.
But Rose immediately, she has all of the good upbringing. First of all, she's terrified and she's crying. Mm-hmm. But then she's also trying to cover because scandal doesn't go well with their breeding. And she's like, oh, it was just an accident, blah, blah, blah. And the maid was like, it's okay. You're okay. Everything's okay, and because Rose is just crying and trying to clean up, and like that was really good with the maid because you can see that Rose is a good person, and the help realize that she's a good person for how they treat her, mm-hmm. and that it also shows it's a good, really good character moment for Rose that humanizes her even more.
Agreed.
Precisely. And we see how Cal wants to break all the good dishes. That's a no-no in my book.
Of course.
I was going to say, that's when you were like, villain.
So right after this, the Rose and Cal and Ruth are getting a tour of the ship, and the captain gets that ice warning. And, you know, the owner of the ship is on the passage, and, you know, his only thought is, okay, well, the headlines have already been how big and how grand the ship is. Now we need more headlines about how fast the ship is. So I want you to turn on all the boilers full speed ahead, even though the captain is thinking, you know, we need to be careful. He's overruled by the owner of the ship. And it's one of those things that, like, you can see all the pieces going into place of how this tragedy happened.
I was going to say, like, they did such a good job because it wasn't even just, like, all at one thing, but, like, right from the beginning, they were doing, like, little bits, you know, about, like, you know, we need to go faster, or there's icebergs ahead, or, you know, there's only enough lifeboats for, like, half of the people. You know, they do it littered so that, like, even if you didn't know what happened to the Titanic going into the movie, like, there's little things going on from while you're watching this love story that, you know, just seems like it doesn't make sense. But then you're like, oh, right, the ship's going to go down.
Well, because Rose befriends Mr. Andrews, who built the ship. And on the deck, she's like, you know, I've done some mathematical calculations, and it doesn't appear that we have enough lifeboats. And Mr. Andrews, Victor Garber, is like, you're right, it's by half. And he goes, I designed these decks so that there could be two boats side by side, and he's blaming it on the owner, didn't think that that looked good, so they removed them all. And you're seeing that it's this still privilege and the aristocracy where looks are more important than function. And in their mind, as all of them are, they're invincible. Mm-hmm. Like, their wealth their station make them invincible.
I mean, that's precisely correct. I mean, we get more evidence when we just look at the corset or the leg of mutton sleeve. But, I mean, in truth, this is part of the movie that's actually very true, and it's accurate. So, although some of the storyline, of course, is fiction, there's a lot of truth in here. And there were signs left and right that there were problems, and they just did not they just wanted to look the other way. And something that recently just came out, I think it's been only just a couple of years these records were released, was that there were already fires out of control when they left Cherbourg, France. So these fires would have rendered the ship needing to be, you know, with it all. Well, junkyard afterwards, right? The ship was already going to be ruined because these fires were out of control, and they were only going to try to control them as they moved or as they positioned in New York. The ship was already lost, and they knew that then. They knew, or they didn't, you know, something else they found out too, you know, there weren't binoculars in the crow's nest. They didn't have emergency flares. They only had party flares. Well, who doesn't love a good party except for when you're in an emergency? I mean, and if you go back in time, any fisherman or any sailor's biggest fear ever is not drowning. It's fire at sea. And they already had that. So it was one bundle and one mistake after another. And until really we just find it hits the apex.
Well, yes. And I'm sorry. Literally. I was just going to say that one of the lines that always stuck out to me is, you know, as it was getting darker that night and they said that the sea was like glass. There were no waves. Everything was flat, which makes it harder to see the icebergs from a distance. Mm-hmm. Yes. And so, I mean, it's another one of those things that they just toss little lines in here, feeding you all the clues.
And I was going to say, and as they're getting ready for the iceberg, so to speak, and everything building up to a head, everything in the romance is building up to a head as well and getting ready for a climax or two.
Right, because Rose originally tells Jack, you know, I can't be with you. And then Jack keeps pushing her, saying, like, no, there's something special here. And they decide to run off together and just have fun. And she had seen all of his drawings and his French girls. And she's a lover of art. And so she's fascinated by his talent because he is talented. And she goes and she shows him the heart of the ocean. And she says, draw me like one of your French girls, wearing this and only this. Meaning wearing the necklace and only the necklace.
And do you know what?
Meaning, draw me like a Parisian prostitute at night.
Yes, a one-legged Parisian prostitute.
Now, babe, is there any
woman of the night?
Well, and what this led to for me was the first boobies, very first boobies, boobies, first boobies, very first boobies I saw.
Which makes sense at 11 that's the first boobies you ever saw.
A lot.
I was going to say that they didn't have too much of an impact, clearly, but they had enough. It did lead to a lifelong fascination with breasts, and I do still love breasts even as a gay man. So I would say that it was love at first sight for me.
Well, I found a pair on sale if you'd like to go buy some. I think you could get that fixed in no time.
I was going to say, I don't like them on me. I'm not wearing breastplates or anything.
Yeah,
but
he doesn't need to go to boobsforqueens.com.
Not a sponsor of Lifetime of Happiness.
Not a sponsor, no. So they...
He draws her,
and
with the heart.
Yep, fun little fact that whenever you see the hand drawing the thing, it is not Leo's hand.
What?
But it is James Cameron's hand that he actually did do the drawing, so the camera is trying to show just the hands, and they're moving so you can't really notice, oh, those hands are 20 years older than they should be. But those are actually James Cameron's hands doing the drawing, which I think is a neat little nod there. They put the necklace back in, like Jack, we see him put it in to the safe. She puts the drawing in there, and she also writes a note, but we don't see at the moment what the note says.
Yeah.
And then they run off, and they're seen by his assistant, who's kind of his thug. And so they're running from him, and they end up running and go down through. So other interesting things. So, like, we see the engine room, and it's pristine, and all these pistons are firing, and there's steam, and it, oh, my goodness, doesn't it look nice? And then you see below, and that's where they're shoveling the coal to make the everything turn. And I was like, wow, even the people that work on the ship, there's class differences. Between,
oh, totally.
Yeah. Like you're not good enough to work in the engine room. You work in the coal shoveling room. Like, that was another whole big thing that even people
the
that aren't
would kill you.
Oh yeah, like those people were going to die of like lung cancer at some point if they didn't drown down there. But they're running and they go through the coal area and then they find the cargo hold where all the cars are stored because, of course, these rich people brought their cars from Europe to America. And they hide
in
one
of the... It's called a horseless carriage. There's nothing wrong with bringing it in. There's nothing wrong with bringing it along.
Now, whenever, like, you know, back in 1912, did your family have a horseless carriage running?
We did.
What color?
And I still have it to this day. Well, I was driving a blue one back. Oh, wait. I gave away so much information.
So they...
I had a blue one. Papa bought it for me.
Papa Diamond. Ronald Wilson, you know, Diamond the First.
I have to tell you something. You know, you know how I always like to bring just a little bit of diversity and inclusion into some of this? Because I think it sometimes some people could be left out of enjoying it as much because they can't maybe relate to certain things. Maybe they, you know, they could a little bit, but they could maybe more if they knew that there was other representation there at that time. And I'd like to just share something that is truthful. There was an interracial family in second class, and the husband was Haitian, and his name was Joseph Philippe Lemercier Laroche, and his wife was from a well-to-do Parisian family, Juliette. They had two little girls, and she was pregnant with a third. So beautiful. And they had been living in Paris, but, you know, they did face discrimination. Them being an interracial family, it was 1912. So they were going back to Haiti because Joseph's uncle was the president. So why not move back to Haiti where your uncle's the president? You're probably going to have less discrimination. So I wanted to share that. Of course, he was a man and died, but the wife and the girls went on to live. And the youngest girl, little Louise, only passed away in 1998. So they went on to have a great life.
Now that you brought that up, it did. There were a couple times that, and I know that it's 1912 and we can't judge things they say by today's standards, but it did annoy me every time Rose was like, I feel like Titanic is a slave ship for me. And I was like,
yeah.
I was like, oh, girl, like, obviously,
well, sure,
you
that's something like someone at that time would be saying.
I know, but like she obviously didn't know the conditions of slave ships.
Yeah.
Clearly not. And, you know, I'm glad you point that out. I think the same thing. I cringe to that. And I think, you know, today we don't make comparisons like that, just like it's not, as a rule, a good thing to make comparisons with the Holocaust. You know, there's not really anything that compares to those sorts of things. But I do know, as a fact, it was, you know, just like the different sayings come throughout different times. There was a saying at that time that working like a slave, or uncle, he's working harder than a slave. Of course, mm-hmm. They weren't working harder. But they had no idea what that meant even. But it was a thing. So a slave ship. I mean, that it's almost like you have these resurgence or these, I don't want to say a renaissance of expression. But in a way, you do see that at that time. You know, just like it was also slang, the British aristocracy started to say ain't. Ain't. And you see that in with Eliza Doolittle in My Fair Lady. Mm-hmm. It's just considered slang, and it's considered cute, or it's considered funny for the upper classes to use it and to say it. But she has no idea what a slave ship was. Mm-mm. She has no idea of its conditions, and so she's just probably saying it to be clever. Again, there are some things I have no tolerance for in the past, like slavery. Mm-hmm. But I think when we begin to take a microscope to some of this stuff and we look at it, we have to be very careful in our judging, and we have to be very careful not to paint with broad brushes.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, I've even seen that in modern day, like, or in my lifetime, because I go back and rewatch Buffy and Angel all the time, and I cringe because back in the 90s to early aughts, it was, you know, people used the R word for people with disabilities to describe people that were stupid or stupid things. And so, like, going back and hearing, like, Cordelia, and I'm, like, my favorite character was on Angel, drop, like, and say the word retarded, like, multiple times, I'm always like, ooh. But, like, back then in the 90s, unfortunately, I mean, that was
what it happened.
It happened, and it
and
was...
And they did it with the word gay. That's retarded. That's gay. Mm-hmm. I mean, my brothers used to say that. I probably even said it. In fact, I'm sure I have. And it was at the end, but, of course, I don't believe in that. We weren't. My mother would have smacked us down. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, the R word was said like that in the 90s. And you know, As a person who loves foreign languages and speaks German and French, it can be a little bit difficult too, because in French, when you're describing, you want to say a person of color, you say the people of color, you know, because you, the adjective has to go after the noun, things like that. And it can change a little bit. And, you know, the word from Latin to, like, to, you know, retard or any sort of retard, it's, you know, to slow down. And so you do use those words in other languages, and you have to be very careful and to think clearly which words you're using in which language and what their meaning is. And because it can change by the decade, as we see.
Oh, absolutely. Life changes and we have to change with it. Now, we get to the part of the movie where, like, we've been building and it's, the movie's fantastic, but we're about to kick into high gear for the last hour because without, you know, even the guy in the crow's nest is like, I can smell ice. No, you can't because the boat hits an iceberg.
Yes, it does. It hits an iceberg while Rose and Jack are screwing in the back seat of a car.
Well, they had finished and they were heading upstairs and, you know, they feel it all and they hear about the seriousness of it. They weren't meant to hear it, but they hear it. At that same time, Cal finds the drawing, the necklace, and the note from Rose, which had said, now you can keep me and it in the safe, meaning her and the necklace in the safe. And so he's already pissed. He calls
the
man at arms and sergeant at arms, and they're going to do an investigation because obviously something's been broken into and things have been stolen, and Jack and Rose are coming back, not knowing anything is really amiss there, to warn people, hey, there's something really bad happening. And all of the sudden, Cal frames Jack for stealing the necklace and gets him arrested. His thug drops the necklace into the coat pocket, and they're like, can we search your coat pocket? And oh, there's the necklace, blah, blah, blah. Things move really fast. Water is starting to sink the ship. They are getting everyone to put on their life jackets. They're trying to get the boats ready. You know, women and children first. We're moving along really, really fast. Yep. The thing that bothered me immediately is so that the first class people could get on the boats first, they lock the steerage people down below. They close all the gates so that no one can get upstairs. Like, that still bothers me every time I watch it.
It's heartbreaking. And I, you know, that's when, you know, you really can, I think that's part of, as I mentioned earlier, that the imagining of your hopes and your dreams in that situation and what's to unfurl, what's to develop. And, you know, just a bit of information, almost of the first class women, and no, first and second class women and children, except for like one or two, one woman and maybe I think it was like one child, were saved. And unfortunately, they could have saved a lot more. The ship was only really at about 60% capacity. They could have had really 2,453 people on board, and they did, and they had 1,317. So yeah, they could have saved a lot more. And many of those could have been the children, at least, and the women, their mothers, from the third class.
Now, whenever they were talking, Mr. Andrews is like, those boats can hold 70 grown men. You can put 60 to 65 women and children on it. You're sending them out with 15 to 20 people on it. From your knowledge of the thing, was that really what was going on? Were the lifeboats underfilled?
The lifeboats were underfilled, and we have historic record to support that. The first boats, at least, were like with 12, 15, 16, and even the people thought this is ridiculous. And so although the custom of the time was, of course, women and children first, we have at least some officers and some crewmen on the other side of the ship, you know, exude a little bit of logic, apply a little bit of critical thinking, some adult analysis, and say, well, you know, if this boat, if the lifeboat isn't full, why can't these men who are standing here go? And that's really the only way any of the first or second class men were saved, but certainly not that many. We know that the Jacob Astor IV, if he would have been on the other side of the ship, if he would have known that he could have gotten in for one of those boats just by the whim of the officer that morning, a moment applying logic, he might have been saved as well.
And like, Rose has her moment to get on the boat with her mother and Molly Brown. And I love Molly's line of, come on, Ruth, first class seats up here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Rose is like, I'm sorry, mother, and doesn't get on. And even Jack and Cal are trying to get Rose to get on one of the boats because it's something they can both agree on. Cal is pretty sure he can weasel his way onto a boat, and he wants Rose to live.
Yes.
And
so does Jack.
And Jack does too. So they're kind of agreeing there. But as it's going down, Rose jumps off the boat onto the second class deck and is pulled inside. And Jack goes chasing after her. They meet at the staircase. And she's like, I couldn't leave without you. And that's when Cal starts chasing them with a gun.
Yeah.
And it's just like, he's lost his mind at that point, but he also realizes...
Well, I was going to say, he also realizes that he left the necklace in the coat that he gave to her to wear when she got on the boat, so she now has the necklace.
And it's one of those things of just, we're screwed, and he now is going to try to save himself at least, because even if he loses the millions from the necklace, his life... is
worth
still
more than anything, and so he steals a child to get on the lifeboat.
Oh, which is just, I mean, it's shameful, but one of the things that I love is the owner of the ship gets on the boat, makes eye contact with one of the sailors, and, like, the shame that the owner feels, I don't know if it outweighs his, well, at least I'm going to be saved, but it seems to be close.
Yeah. 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 I mean, the reality and in real life, the rest of his life, he was a social pariah and basically lived as a hermit.
Really?
That was the rest of his man's life. Huh. So not really. So, I mean, one way or the other, he got his just desserts. I don't know if it equals death, but at the same time, he was a pariah in society. He was shunned. No one would have any interaction with him. People who survived knew he had pushed and pushed and pushed. Something that very few people know, actually, is that Captain Smith pushed and pushed, too, because it was his retirement cruise. Uh-huh. So, or crossing, rather. It's not a cruise. It's a crossing. So, I mean, and in that, yeah. So, that's how he spent his time on this planet.
Mm. Yeah, and that's, I mean, it's karma.
Yeah, and as they're trying to survive, this is when it really comes to and goes from a rom-com to a full-blown disaster movie, and that's when you just get so excited, babe.
Like, well, and that's one of the things that he's created this epic drama that becomes an action disaster film that he knows how to do action, obviously.
Yeah.
And it's unbelievable how tense and exciting and well done that it is, that last 45 minutes or so where it's starting to sink and they're running.
And body is dropping left and right, literally. Yeah,
and like the boat is breaking in half and it's just so well done.
And then you see at the very last minute, you know, they always say we're only 9 meals away from complete anarchy. Watch how humans behave. And that is, I think, a good representation. Watch how humans, or a good light, rather, a likeness, and how humans behave in those moments, regardless of class. They behave like animals. Well, that's what they revert to.
Yeah. You did see the people trying to mob the last of the boats. You saw the people that, as the ship was sinking, were bowing and praying with the preacher.
Yeah.
And some people that were willing to throw other people under to get to safety and trampling them. And
then you saw others, like the steerage class woman that couldn't get upstairs, took her children back to bed and was telling them a bedtime story to keep them calm before they died. Or the old couple that were just cuddling in bed. Mm-hmm. Like
those are the Isidore, that's Mr. and Mrs. Strauss. That's a representation of, and those characters. And you see the best of humanity and you see the vulgars, the worst. I personally would have gone back to my stateroom on the A deck and dressed in drag and gotten to my first class lifeboat and sailed away with Ruth.
what was your name was Veronica?
My heart.
What was the last name? Because
I didn't have a drag name, you fool. That was something you all made up to start rumors and lies.
Oh, that's right. That's why I can't remember it. Yeah, we called you Veronica something or other, and I can't remember what the last name was.
Yeah,
you made up May. You called it M-A-E.
That's it, May. Veronica May. That was
and
it.
And Dominic Castuccio would go, Veronica May. I'd say, hey, what a gay horse is eat. Hey.
Okay, so Jack and Rose are in the water. He gets her over to this floating door that's like for an armoire. And gets her up on there, and he only tries once to climb on, and it tips over, and then he's like, you just stay up there. This is what I always have problems with, because I know it's story dictated, but there was damn enough room for both of them to be on that door.
Mm-hmm. They should have picked a smaller door if they were going to make it seem like she was the only one who could fit in.
Rose doesn't move. Jack freezes to death. And so while this is happening, finally, one boat, like, because all of the lifeboats are out there and people are like, we should go back. And they're like, they'll mob us. They'll take us all under. And Molly Brown's like, look at you people. Like, those are your men out there. And none of the women are, they're all, you know, they're all scared, rightly so. And they're concerned about themselves. But it shows Molly was, you know,
the only strong one.
The only really strong one that she's like, hey, we are safe. There are some people that we could save as well. One boat does go back, but by then, everybody but Rose is dead. And she finally,
let's go, as she says. She'll never let go. And when I was very confused because I didn't understand what metaphor was back in the time. So I was like, but she just let him go.
But she had promised him to live. She gets in, she blows the whistle, and she's saved. And they only pulled like two or three people out of the water that were still alive because only one boat came back, which is...
Yeah, and that's real life. In real life, only one boat turned back. And in real life, there were about six people who were saved, one of whom was a complete drunk who'd been drinking all evening, and that's how that drunk lived. I think it was one of my friends.
I was about, you finished the joke before I could say, so that's how you're still here to this day.
No, of course, I just floated away on a boat of liquor. Now, and then... And in real life, one of the survivors was young Jack Thayer, whose mother had already been saved, of course, whose father drowned. He was, I think, 14, 15, 16 at the time, somewhere through there. His father was the vice president of the Pennsylvania Railroad. So he was, somehow he was lucky enough, the one of the six, to not freeze, and he was saved, and he went on to live a life.
Now, one of the tragic things that we see, and it's shown while the ship is breaking apart, you know, a lot of windows are breaking and water's filling up, but then they show us where all the china is stored and the china is falling off the shelves and breaking. How do you feel about that?
Most heartbreaking part of the film for me. And you know, they don't just show it once, twice, they show it thrice. Oh, those beautiful dishes falling, crashing. You know, it's not all of them broke. I paused the movie and I saw where several were saved. Those could have been saved from the bottom of the sea. That's well, the most heart-wrenching part for me. That and the bigger question of whatever happened to Ruth after them. She was collected by the Carpathia.
Well, do tell. Do you, like, if you don't know and, you know, because it's a fictional character, in your mind, what happens to Ruth?
I think she froze to death.
You think somebody pushed her off and...
Or just that it was...
Certainly not. Certainly not. She's a survivor. I think she went back and she made fraudulent insurance claim. And then she settled well with this White Star Line. And lived happily ever after and not as a seamstress.
So, in your mind, Ruth is not one of the villains of the movie?
No, Ruth is practical. She has to ensure... Ruth must secure the family's survival, and hanging around with an old drunk playing cards and gambling isn't the way to do it. She's right.
So Rose survives. She's on the ship. the Carpathian. They come around asking for names, and she changes her last name to Dawson in honor of Jack. Cal had gone down to the third class area to look for people, and Rose hid herself, and that was the last time she ever saw him. And we hear that though Cal did live that whenever the stock market crashed in 29, that he lost, you know, most of his money and he blew his brains out.
Yeah. So he had that. He had that personality anyway. That fictional, you know, the heart of the ocean, that diamond was valued, was supposed to be valued at, in reality, of that close to the Hope diamond, which at present is worth $250 million. So he would have had that. That's why he wants that stone back so badly, no doubt.
Now, let's.
So we see what kind of character he is.
Yes, and as we see that after she gives the name and after she hides, she reaches into the pocket and notices that she has it. So flash forwarding to modern day, old woman Rose goes out on the balcony at night and we see it in her hands. And what does she do with it, babe?
She pitches it into the ocean like an idiot.
Well, she says,
I will
oops.
Be the bitch.
She says,
I will
oops.
Be the bitch.
Yeah, like, and I, it's so ridiculous that I know that, like, she didn't need it to survive and live all those years because she was an actress and she did get to ride horses on the beach and she flew an airplane and she ended up living a life well lived like she had promised Jack that they were going to. So that's great. But you have this.
But her granddaughter wasn't. Her granddaughter wasn't.
No. Yeah.
She had to wear the same jeans the whole movie. and something else, that blanket that Rose was wearing in the end to conceal herself from Hal.
That was
that's
Burberry.
Same blanket she was, that's that same blanket she's wearing, too, when she's rescued in the beginning, from when Jack saves her from falling over. And then they put that blanket around her as some sort of comforting shield.
Now,
same blanket.
Same now, blanket. At the end, you know, after she dies in her bed, an old woman, like Jack said she was going to, she re-enters the Titanic as her 17-year-old self again, and she and Jack meet on the staircase, and all the people that died on the ship are there, and they cheer, and then it's over.
She's home.
Now, I have a question for both of you. So, like, back then, this was the most luxurious mode of transportation. Let's say that something today, like, if they invented a new type of, you know, the Concorde was the fastest way to fly from Europe to the U.S. Let's say that there's a new plane that is more luxurious and can go even faster. Who in the world, like, of people that are names, do you think would be honored with tickets on this first new, like, super plane?
Ronnie, of course.
Ronald Wilson, Diamond II, von Habsburg, and Hohenzollern.
Trash. No.
I was going to say, well, if it was on an airplane, he has his connections.
Well, that is true. But, I mean, do you think, like, obviously, do you think the
Well, I think the way you bring up is really cool because we're seeing it almost in real time now. Maybe that next big flight, that next big journey is really what Sir Richard is doing and Bezos is doing at this moment with these little space flights. Not that little, these space flights. And so maybe that's a good... What, that gives us some vision into how that might look.
I was going to say, and turning it around on us, mm-hmm. or like the listeners to think of, like if you were given the chance to be on the very first luxury spacecraft to take you to Mars to start your new life, would you go on round one on the Titanic space version?
Well, and that's a good question. Like, do you think that it would be people like Prince William and Princess Kate? Do you think that it would be people like Beyonce and Jay-Z? Would Beyonce, even though, you know, she's world famous, would she and Jay-Z be looked down upon because they're entertainers? What do you think?
Well, entertainers at that time were definitely looked upon differently than today. I mean, that's just...
Well, like, and so, or let's say...
And I mean, we always have to remember, I think we often confuse, too, like, we...
Wealth class, with class?
Yeah, you can be rich trash, and you can be poor as can be, but be like the absolute epitome of class.
Well, so, like the Kardashians, like would be
trash with money is still trash.
Exactly. So if the Kardashians were on there, they would be looked down upon.
Molly Brown.
Like Molly Brown. Yeah. Okay. So
speaking of music entertainers, what did you think of the band playing on while the ship sank?
I think that's music to drown by. No, but I mean, really quickly, I mean, I'm not saying Beyonce is trash because I don't think she is, but I'm saying things like Kardashians or something like that. I mean, really, honestly, the equivalent of in that movie, what we were talking about just now is really like Molly Brown.
Mm-hmm.
The new money. That's really what we're talking about.
Right. And yeah. Like the band playing,
oh, yeah,
as they were ordered to entertain the people while they were waiting for the lifeboats. Is that just something of...
Well, they weren't ordered. They were doing it out of a sense of duty. Now, I think that's something that has gone by the wayside. A sense of duty, a sense of responsibility, a sense of... And you know, and probably for the better in most cases. But I think they weren't doing it out of being ordered to do it. They were doing it out of a sense of obligation and duty.
We are over 100 years past the sinking of the Titanic. Do you think people 100 years from now will still be fascinated with it?
Oh, I certainly do.
I do.
I think people are just fascinated with that, the imagining your dreams and possibly going up in smoke.
I was going to say, we also love a good disaster.
Right, and I kind of thinking like how...
Our Inferno.
Well, you know, we talk about the Titanic, they talk about the attack on Pearl Harbor, 9/11. Like, I think there are certain...
I'm terrified for the movie, you know, down the road when they do a Titanic version of 9/11.
Oh, I'm... Like, they were already working on it before about a love story of... people that worked in the towers, mm-hmm. and like trying to get out. And I think that it was put on hold because they were like, it's too soon. And that people were still too raw about it. But
yeah, and
that's coming.
I have to tell you, I have to tell you too, like for the listeners, especially there are, if you want to watch a version of Titanic, that's actually closer to the history and, you know, a bit with less fiction, if you will, there are so many versions. There's one from the 50s, there's one from the 80s, there's one from like 1 or 2 years before this one came out, like 95 96. I think that was a mini series on Lifetime. There's one that came out in 2012. There's one that, you know, they're all the time, and they're a little bit closer to the real history. So I wanted to throw that out there for the listeners, because they're, each one of them is fascinating to watch.
Wasn't
and several
there,
countries have done several versions of them.
Wasn't there a version done by the guy that did Downton Abbey?
Julian Fellowes, yes. And that is available on Amazon. And I think it was really good. It was really good.
Because the one that you were talking about in the 90s actually starred Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Yep, it did. And that's a good one, too. I have that one as well.
Yep.
Happy to share.
Do you know that, like, we now think of Titanic as Leo and Kate, but there was almost a different Jack and Rose, because Gwyneth Paltrow and Matthew McConaughey were originally in talks to star.
Like, I could see that. I mean, because Gwyneth can pull off the, you know, the equivalent of the young lady, a member of the aristocracy, and he certainly can pull off some old riffraff running through the road.
Once that fell through, like, Kate Winslet was really campaigning for the part, and she was sending James Cameron flowers.
Roses.
And roses specifically, with notes saying "from your rose" after she auditioned. And like, and this was a movie that changed her life forever. Like, Kate Winslet, we now know her as an amazing actress. Like, we recently saw her in Mayor of Easttown on HBO.
Fantastic.
It's so good. So, you know, you love Celine Dion and her backwards tuxedo from the Oscars, but did you know?
Don't forget the hat that came with that.
Yes, not to forget the hat. Do you know the song "Almost Wasn't"?
Really?
That would have been a colossal mistake.
Well, because Cameron only wanted songs without words, but composer James Horner worked with lyricist Will Jennings and Celine, and they secretly recorded a demo for it, And James Cameron heard it and was like, okay, I love this. And so you know that you hear it so many times during the movie.
But just the instrumental. But then you hear it with the words in the credits.
Yes. So the song itself won the Academy Award for Best Original Song. It won the 1999 Grammys. It won Record of the Year, Song of the Year, Best Female Pop Vocal Performance, and Best Song Written Specifically for a Motion Picture. It also won the Golden Globe Award for Best Original Song.
And I remember it being on the radio for weeks and weeks. It was on 10 weeks at number one.
10 weeks at number one. It sold 18 million copies. And, of course, my senior prom theme was My Heart Will Go On.
Yeah.
I'm so glad to hear that because I'd like to take the opportunity to serenade you now.
Do go away. Now, it sounds just like Celine.
Yeah.
Now,
my thoughts exactly.
Now, what also went on was the Titanic being in the movie theaters. Isn't that true?
It is because, like, the movie, like, movies usually, if you don't see it in the first 45 to 60 days, you're going to have to wait for it to come nowadays out on video or streaming.
Yeah.
But back then, this movie was around for months. So we said it was released on December 19th in 1997. Whenever it came out on VHS on September 1st, 1998, it was still in the theaters. That is the first and still only film to stay in the theaters that long.
Yeah, I was going to say that's almost 10 full months.
I know people, Ronnie, how many times do you think you saw Titanic in the theater?
Oh, at least a handful.
I saw it twice in the theater.
Sorry, I was ringing my shame bell from.
So, Ronnie, my darling, now I'm calling you darling so that you'll understand. What are your thoughts about Titanic, the movie, and its legacy?
Well, of course, I've always been in love with it and always will be. As a legacy, I would love to see another blockbuster that James Cameron would do that would be very similar to this. Of course, different in its own way, 20-some years later, but actually be closer to history. So the musical Titanic, which was fantastic, and I hope you listen to the music. I mean,
I saw it on Broadway.
Yes, and it is wonderful. It is closer to the real life, right? It's not as fiction, and it has the real characters and their names. The music relates to the people's lives. I would love to see, as a legacy, a version of Titanic of the same quality as like this, except, you know, for modern time, and reflect the reality of the passengers a little bit more and really show us some of the insights of their lives and show us that character development that I just crave. So that would be great. And I would also like to continue seeing the lifeboats being seated according to class.
Now, there were rumors for years that I've never been able to find confirmation or official denial, but allegedly there is an hour more of Kathy Bates' Molly Brown footage that was cut from the film whenever he realized the love story he had and that the extra Molly Brown stuff would affect the pacing of the love story. Would you enjoy like a director's cut that adds back in more Molly Brown stuff?
I would love that because the reality is she, her character, it was a real character, and maybe we don't know, but if the rumors are to be true, maybe we would see more insight into that. And maybe that insight would not be fictional, that it would be factual. And that would be wondrous to behold.
I agree. Darling, I know that you last night, as we were watching it, what were you saying?
Well, I was saying that, I mean, I'm glad that we rewatched it before recording because, A, that's just good podcasting research.
Yeah.
But, B, because, you know, originally when I agreed to do this episode, it was more of an act of love for Ronnie because I watched it when I was 11 and didn't really like it because it was a really long movie and I had the attention span of an 11-year-old. I thought it was a documentary and I was shook when I found out it was fiction. And it just, like, it was just a long, boring romance, in my opinion, when I was younger, that to the point where I didn't even really watch it as an adult. And so this is probably the second time I've ever watched
watch the movie in full, and it's awesome now as an adult. Like, and it aged better than most movies do. Like, it aged really well. It holds up. I appreciated the romance of it. I appreciated the action of it. It just, if it wasn't for this podcast and for this rewatch, I would still be thinking negatively ill of the Titanic.
Well, and
I'm flattered you did this for me, but if you want to show me true love, let's do a podcast on Grey Gardens.
We'll watch it.
I was going to say, TBD, Ronnie, TBD.
Now, are you talking about the one with Drew Barrymore, or are you talking about the documentary?
No, screw the documentary. It's well pictured and painted in the one with Jessica Lange and Barrymore.
Okay,
good to know.
And so whenever Titanic came out, and then it kind of became almost like, oh, you're watching Titanic, or oh, you enjoy Titanic. It became so popular that it became popular to look down on the movie. And I can honestly say it's probably been a decade or more since I've watched the whole thing. And I have to say, like you did, that it holds up so well. But I think that James Cameron created a modern masterpiece with this movie that it's only, 24 years old. It'll be 25 next year, and maybe they'll put it back into theaters for a short run. But this movie, it doesn't make any missteps. Like, the writing is so good. The acting is phenomenal. The visuals are fantastic. The attention to detail that he put into this, that it has been talked about in articles and things, it's very, very true. Like, the care he put into this shows, and I think that's why it has aged as well as it did. And I hope that people that haven't seen this for, 10 plus years or something, will go back and watch it and realize how good it really is.
I do too. Definitely worth it.
Well, Ronnie, it is coming to the end of the show where we would ask you, do you have any final thoughts or anything last you would like to say to our listeners?
If I could save one dish to add to my collection in France. Oh, that's all.
Well, thank you once again for joining us. For our Ronnie fans out there, he will be coming back whenever we do any more seasons of Downton Abbey, and we will give Grey Gardens a look to see if it would flow well for the show.
All right.
I was going to say, listeners, if you want to hear Ronnie back for Grey Gardens or for us to move up our Downton Abbey series in the timeline, let us know by chiming in on Facebook
or Twitter
or Instagram at Happy Life Pod.
And you can also get in touch with us directly at happylifepod@gmail.com.
Excellent. And until next time, everyone,
stay happy.
You're still here, which is great, because there's something we probably forgot to mention this episode.
That is correct. Each episode, as we're discussing movies, music, and games, there's a good chance we've used a small clip or two from the original source material.
Yes, and those clips are not ours. We do not own the rights to any of the music or clips. They were used to help solicit a discussion to appreciate the original source material.
And with that, if you are still listening, you likely really appreciate our material as well.
I mean, how could you not? And if you've enjoyed this episode, then you should also ask yourself, when's the last time I told a friend to check out A Lifetime of Happiness?
If your answer was not today, well, it should be.
Yes, so go tell your best girlfriend about our podcast today, and don't forget to subscribe or follow us wherever you're listening to get new episodes each Wednesday.
Stay happy.